And I saw the first episode and I was blown away. I thought to myself, yes, this is exactly what I envisioned. It's an incredible show. It's Out of Africa meets Legends of the Fall meets Yellowstone.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go again, another episode of Story and Craft. I am Mark Preston, and I'm so glad you popped by. Today, Sebastian Roche. We're going to chat about his acting career, all the things he's done. I mean, he's one of those guys that shows up in TV and film, and you know, things are about to become interesting. He's been in The Man in the High Castle, The Young Pope, Vampire Diaries, Six Underground with Ryan Reynolds, and the new show he's in, Taylor Sheridan's 1923. Great show, if you've been seeing it. If not, you gotta check it out. Of course, we will be chatting about his career, and he grew up in a really cool way. I'm very envious of his childhood. We'll talk about that. And don't forget, anything and everything you want to know about Story and Craft, easy to find out. Just pop over to storyandcraftpod.com. Like the show. Leave a review if you so desire. Follow. That way you get notified every time a new episode rolls out. All right, let's get after it. Today is Sebastian Roche Day. Right now on Story and Craft. So how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing really excellently.
Where are you located right now? Are you in the UK? Are you stateside here? Or
No, I actually live in Venice. I've been living in the States for 30 years now. 30 long years in the States, 15 years in New York, and 15 in California.
Okay.
Love California.
Oh, so Venice, you're meaning the Los Angeles area as opposed to Venice.
Yeah. It's Venice, California.
I was going to say, that's going to be a first for my show here, talking with someone who's in is in Venice, Italy. That's pretty cool.
Who's in Venezia.
But congratulations on 1923. That is I definitely will be touching on that in a moment, but that's the excitement's building on that, most certainly. That's
It's very, very exciting.
Well, I was gonna ask you, I was just my two kids are in college, but and if we go back to when they I'm hitting rewind, I don't know, maybe 10 years a little bit more when Fringe was on TV. They were a little too young. Now they love it. So whenever they're home from school, we're kind of binge watching Fringe. And right now, you're featuring very prominently in that part of our watching.
Yeah.
I'm really late to the game on a lot of stuff, and I just finished Man in the High Castle. I just finished it. So
yes,
and I mean, as you know, there's so much to watch now that it's like I'm playing catch up on things I meant to watch 2 years ago or three or four. Yeah. You know, where in the UK are you originally from?
I was actually born in Paris, France. My father is French, educated in Britain, and my mother's Scottish, educated in Egypt, actually. So I come from a family of sort of very, very multilingual family. My father was born in Vienna, actually, because his father was in the diplomatic service. But I was born and raised around Paris, first in Paris, then we moved to the suburbs of Paris, and I went to an international school for many years. And then my father decided that corporate life wasn't for him, and he bought a sailing boat, and we took off for 6 years on a sailing boat. So from the age of 12 to 18, I was living, you know, in sort of the Mediterranean, Africa, the Caribbean, South America.
I need to stop and kind of live vicariously through you for just moment. I'm going, God, that's... That has been my dream. There's a producer in who lives in down in Encinitas, and I used to live near him. And he's just a cool guy. He's one of those kind of younger guys, young at heart, and he's always doing something. He just kind of cuts loose. He's a digital nomad, and he just lives on a boat and sails around Greece. I'm like going,
oh, wonderful.
I was like, how do I get that gig? So I am always envious of him. Now I'm going to be envious of you. How did that come together again, where you were sailing around? How did that become part of your early life?
Well, my father was started reading these adventure sailing books in the 70s, you know, when sailing was, you know, it wasn't as popular as it is now. It's always been very popular in France, but we started becoming weekend sailors. My father bought a small boat. We started sailing, going to Brittany on the west coast of France to sail, and then graduated to a slightly bigger boat. and continued sailing, and you know, it became a real passion for him. And he was a corporate man and never saw us. And he said, you know, that's it, I'm done. I'm selling the house and buying a boat, and you know, fulfilling my dream after reading all those books by celebrated sailors who were living on their boats at the time. This was the, you know, mid 70s, and so we, you know, my father announced to us, to the whole family, that we were leaving, selling the house. I was terrified because I didn't have the affinity that I have now for sailing. And we set off, you know, from the west coast of France, did the whole Mediterranean, west coast of Africa, across the Atlantic. Took three weeks to cross the Atlantic and arrived in the Caribbean. And from there was kind of the base for 4.5 years. To go to South America and the Caribbean, and
so you kind of focused on the Caribbean as far as kind of the start and end point for all your adventures around the this part of the world.
Yeah, the Lesser Antilles, you know, the arc from basically the Bahamas to Trinidad and Tobago and the South American coast. It's really a wonderland of for sailing. So we were sort of based in Martinique and. At one point, and you know, because we were French speaking, and you know, within a year we were broke, and my father needed a job. He became a tour guide in Martinique. I gave windsurfing lessons. My mum repaired sails, and then we moved on, and then Tortola in the British Virgin Islands became our second sort of base, and yeah, so this was a sort of 5-6 years on a boat that were. That truly changed my outlook on life.
And I mean, how could it not? I mean, that's just like, were you cognizant at that age that you were having a very unique experience that not many other people got to have, or was this just your norm?
No, I understood that this was a once in a lifetime experience. I mean, as soon as, you know, as I left, as I was telling you, I was kind of a fearful kid, not very good at school, and it sort of built my the sailing and the trip in itself built my self-confidence as a person. I became passionate about spearfishing and freediving and shell collecting, and I became really good at it. You know, amongst my brothers, I became the quote unquote the best at it. And it built my confidence as a person, and you know, having the responsibility of working on a boat, you know, because my dad, you know, would make us do all the chores, and you learn very quickly to be extremely adaptable, to have the responsibility of having a night watch, you know, or a morning watch. These are things that take a huge amount of responsibility on a boat. You're responsible for the safety of the boat. So it makes you grow up very fast. And also I was a very avid reader. So I devoured anything that I could, because this was way before the internet. You know, we didn't have a TV. We had the radio, BBC World Service, that my mother listened to mostly. And so you are immersed in this extraordinary adventure, and you're discovering new cultures.
It's almost kind of a Hemingway-esque in a way, kind of.
Yeah, it's very Hemingway-esque. It's very Mosquito Coast in a way, when you come to think of it. Going back to Harrison Ford, you know.
It is a bit that.
My father wanted to experience something different with his children, and you know, and the closeness of the confined nature of living on a sailing boat pushes you to adapt and to actually go deeper into a family dynamic. It was a fascinating experience.
How many brothers do you have?
Two brothers. So we were three boys on the boat, and after a couple of years, my older brother left. You know, he had enough, and he was. I don't think he was, you know, he was at that age where he was like, I'm 18, I'm out of here. And my younger brother then, after a few years too, couldn't deal with the schooling, the homeschooling, and he was sent to boarding school. And basically the last few years I was by myself with my parents. And I enjoyed that responsibility of being in charge of the whole sailing boat, of the inner workings and outer workings of the boat. It really... It matured me to an amazing extent. Yeah, I embraced it.
Is that still something that's part of your life now? Do you still sail, or do you have a boat, or is it, you know, or is this something you left as a chapter in your youth?
Yeah, yeah, I still actually sail. I you know, I do the sort of racing, the summer series, Marina Del Rey. We do these racing series every Wednesday. Is it Yeah, every Wednesday we sail on these J109s, which are sort of sailing boats specifically made for racing. So that's a fun part of sailing. I personally prefer the I would prefer myself to own my boats and be solo navigating, but you know, that's, I don't have the time to do that at the moment. But so I do enjoy the racing, but I've continued. Yeah, my younger brother is a captain on adventure cruise ships, and my older brother used to build maxi yachts. He's not in that business anymore, but we've continued sort of sailing when we can. You know, it's difficult when it's difficult to make any plans as an actor, because you never know when your next job is going to come.
Yeah. Well, you said your father, I guess your grandparents were in foreign service, and your father's a corporate guy, and your brothers are doing the boat. Begs the question, how did you end up being the thespian of the family? Is this something that, was there someone else that you were kind of looking at, or you're like, this is just being on the boat, and you said, and reading, and was it just that you had that time to kind of let your imagination just kind of flex and go different places? Is that part of what drew you into acting?
It came before. It came very, very early on. I found myself, you know, loving to imitate people and having a fascination for theater and film as a kid. And it's something I remember, you know, very clearly at 6 years old, or around that age, saying, yeah, when I grow up, I'm going to be an actor. I would love to disguise myself and create adventures in my head. And I thought to myself, this is truly what I want to do. Of course, it's, you know, when you're that young, it's such it's such a sort of a dreamlike idea. And you know, then we had that moment on the boat from 12 to 18 where I was thinking, how am I going to be an actor? But I remember very well leaving the islands and my parents and going back to Europe, basically, to pursue my craft as an actor. I truly, you know, I didn't do school plays because I was homeschooled, so like a lot of people did. But, you know, in my imagination, this is what I wanted to do. I had a fascination for film. My grandparents gave me this book called Halliwell's Film Goer's Companion, which I memorized. I remember memorizing it and trying to see as many films as I could whenever we saw our parents, or whenever I could get hold of a television. I would basically imprint my brain with any form of film. And notably, my experiences in Tortola in the Virgin Islands, I would go to the Carib Cinema, which was the local cinema, and experience, you know, as many movies as I could. I remember watching, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time, and many other films there, which were really important to my development in wanting to become an actor. Yeah.
Well, that had to be an interesting full circle when you sat down with Harrison Ford. You know, just
yes.
I think. Finally, we're all of that age where, you know, we're older guys, but we can, like, we're very much like, you can't be around Harrison and not remember that kid that saw that movie, you know, or like Star Wars, or, you know.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, yeah.
Were you in the UK or were you in France? Where were you going to school over there?
When I was in France, I would go to this international school near Paris called the Lycée International, you know, the International Lycée, where I was subjected to many, many, many cultures. There were people from all over the world, from Asia, from Africa, from the US, from Britain. And I was in the British section. So, you know, hence my English accent. And of course, we always used to talk to one another in two languages at home. So it was a sort of normal occurrence to jump from one language to the other. But I truly had a fascination for my British culture. I as a kid, I wanted to be in England. I wanted to be Scottish. I had a fascination with my Scottish heritage, my tartan, the colors of my family. You know, we'd heard histories of my mother's a Stuart, you know, comes from that family tradition. And I would go to my grandparents, and you know, they used to have the family tree, this extraordinary family tree in a frame, and I would dream of history, you know, my Scottish heritage, which dated back to the 11th century, actually.
Isn't that funny to see, when you see that, and with this, like the 23andMe and all, you know, the DNA tests you can put out there. I did a little just cursory online research, the most basic, and I could actually track back to where I had people who were knights in the family, and they had a castle in England, and that's one side of the family, and the other side's like Jewish and Eastern Europe. You know, this is interesting, but I thought it was cool. I told my son, I was like, you know, there were knights in our family back. And actually, it's funny that they financed the Mayflower.
Oh, my God.
So going, I was like, how random is that to find? But you're there, and in Scotland, the castle's family name, where, you know, there is the castle steward or whatever. Is it just one, or is it usually they have different castles all under the same family name? I always wondered about that.
I actually don't know of any of our family castles. All I know is that, you know, my family comes from the Stuart of Appin branch of the Stuart clan, which is basically, you know, goes all the way to Mary Queen of Scots, to James the First, to, you know, we are extremely distant cousins of the royal family. If you look at our tree. But what's really fascinating is the start, you know, the first name on the tree is Fleance of Lochaber, who was the son of Banquo. Banquo being, Banquo being one of the main characters of the tragedy of Macbeth by Shakespeare. So it's really fascinating. This is, again...
You really brought it full circle.
I brought it full circle again. It's just fascinating to see the names on the tree: Robert the Bruce, Charles Edward Stuart of Scotland, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie, and and this continued throughout my life. As a child, I was fascinated by that whole history and the British side of my family. I sort of rejected the French side, and I just wanted to be British, which explains why after I finished I went back to France. Tried to get into drama school in England, was too expensive for me, so I went back to France, where I went to this wonderful, the best drama school in France, the National Conservatory of Acting, for 3 years, which is free, and they give you a scholarship, because most of graduate studies in France are free. Actually, all graduate studies in France are free. And but as soon as I graduated, my mind, my heart was in England or somewhere English speaking, and I was going to move to England, and found myself deciding to go to New York. Arrived in New York in 1992 and never left. And here I am.
Was theater and acting, was that the initial objective? I mean, you have brothers that went into the whole maritime thing, but so it's always been that track.
It's always been theater and acting. And actually, when I went to the National Drama School, the French National Drama School of Acting, it was all about theater. Theater was my passion. You know, the greats, the Shakespeare, Molière. This is what I wanted to do: Pinter, Ibsen, Strindberg, classical theater. And that was my trajectory. And of course, you know, if you got into film or TV, that was the icing on the cake, because you made more money, of course, doing that. But that was really the trajectory. I really wanted to go then to graduate from being in France to going to England. I'd already found an agent in England. I was going to move there, and found myself in New York, and, you know, thought, you know... Applied for a green card, got it very quickly, and auditioned, and was instantly welcomed with open arms by the acting community, and started working quite a lot. I'd worked quite a lot already in France on American co-productions, where, you know, TV co-productions that came to France, and I'd done quite a bit of television and stage already. So I had a body of work, and with complete gusto, and, you know, the arrogance and that you can have at that age, literally called every agent and said, "Hey, I'm here, hire me," or I'll audition for you and I'll get into your agency. And that's what I did. And
well, that's the reason why I don't know if I would have the energy to get into this business at my age. You know, it's like this is something like early 20s. You're just pure tenacity and, you know, and you're kind of fearless and you don't really have the... You're not maybe as politic as maybe you would be as a little bit.
It's so true. When I look back at my how fearless I was in those days, it's staggering how fearless I was. I just can't believe it. Prior to that, I'd done a movie called Last of the Mohicans. You know, I'd come to the States before I actually finally settled and came to the States and auditioned for this casting director who knew a casting director, a friend of mine in France. And next thing you know, I meet her and she's like, okay, come by next week and you'll audition with Michael Mann and Daniel Day-Lewis. And I was like, fine. And I came back, auditioned with Daniel, and they gave me a little part in, didn't get the part that I wanted, but they gave me a part and I ended up, you know, 6-7 weeks in North Carolina shooting this extraordinary film. And that, you know, again, sort of pushed me to come back to the U.S. and apply for that green card and stay and, you know, be there as a member of the American acting community who really, truly, truly embraced me with open arms. And,
you know, early on, and I can only go, you know, from my experience, which I, it's fun. Like I said, my kids are finally at that age where they can watch some of the shows that maybe were a little age inappropriate. And they love Fringe, but 24 was our jam for a little while, and I know
I was in that too. Yeah.
Now I'm going to go back and rewatch some of these episodes. A number of months ago, I was speaking with Rupert Evans, and I was like,
I haven't watched all.
I watched maybe 3/4 of one episode of Man in the High Castle, and I was like, it's one of those things I got to come back to because I know it's a little bit of an investment of time to when you say what if, you know, like what if, you know, that show was done so well,
very well that
your part in it I think was a big kind of interesting transition point, and it was just I'm curious where y'all shot that that film or that show.
So we shot the show in Vancouver. Actually, all of it was shot in Vancouver, and they were extraordinary. There was so much minutiae applied to this show in terms of production design
and wardrobe and design.
It was truly extraordinary. So we shot actually, I mean, you know, where I was, which was Hitler's office, pretty much, was actually in the Air Canada studios in the middle of Vancouver. And a lot of it, you know, my house was this beautiful house in a sort of area of Vancouver. Everything was shot in Vancouver, and that was quite remarkable, actually, that they managed to do that. That show was really a wonderful experience for me as an actor. It sort of, I really felt that because of the writing and the quality of the show, my acting took a step further in a new direction that I wanted it to go to. And
Is you're playing the father of someone who was in their
early
mid to 20s. Was that the first time you kind of took that next step? Well, okay, well now I'm not that guy. Now I'm now somebody who's
someone's father.
Well, you have somebody's father, but of course, you know, you were one of the big guys in the Reich, you know, so that, you know, you were kind of a revered, that dynamic. I just love that part of the storyline. I thought that was such a great turn.
Yeah, it was a wonderful storyline. It was a really interesting role because at first I didn't know where the story was going to go. All I knew is that he was a Reichsminister, and actually you think he's a certain kind of person at the beginning, and you realize towards the end that he is actually the main...
he's the puppet master, kind of, in a way. Yeah.
Antagonist. He really is the puppet master, that was a very interesting progression for me.
Yeah, I'm so glad Rupert Evans convinced me. He's like, you got to go finish watching. I was like, I will, where was I fine?
Yeah, Rupert's wonderful in it, too. Wonderful, wonderful. A great... I mean, such wonderful actors in that show, you know, from Rufus Sewell, Rupert Evans, Joel De La Fuente as Inspector Kido, and so many others, and Alexa Davalos. The cast was truly, truly wonderful, and actually welcomed me also with open arms, and it was a wonderful experience for me.
I think you've done some just, you know, very memorable, no matter where you land, very memorable roles. But now, do you have a preference, though? Do you like film or TV? And TV, of course, since the days when you started, has certainly taken on a whole new kind of vibe, you know, with the streamers and everything. Do you have a preference?
I don't, actually. For me, I approach a role in exactly the same way, whether I'm on a, you know, if we can call that, you know, I don't know how to, whether you're on a film or on a TV set, for me, I approach it exactly the same way. I approach it with the same enthusiasm and detail in research and responsibility as an actor and professionalism. I think that's really, really important. I have as much passion being on a stage as a movie set or a TV set. And now that TV has reached a sort of level of a film, because I truly believe that it has, in the last 5 to 6 years, with the advent of streamers, money now is poured into television, where films can't actually compete, because you can't finance certain kinds of movies. You wouldn't be able to make Man in High Castle as a film anymore financially.
You know, the HBO show Entourage, I was kind of rewatching it. You know, Jeremy Piven's character, he plays Ari Gold, the agent.
Yeah.
And they're slamming on TV. This is 2008, 2009. They're slamming on TV. It's like, no, it's going to kill your career. It's so funny how times have changed, where, case in point, Harrison Ford, you know, big marquee movie star. TV, you know, so there's that fluidity, you know, you can go back and forth and nobody cares anymore, which is kind of, you know.
But it has to do with the writing, because, you know, now that we're talking about Harrison Ford and him taking on 1923, which is, you know, within the Yellowstone universe, you know, we have to talk about Taylor Sheridan. This is someone I've been wanting
to say.
Yeah. This is someone I've been wanting to work with for so long. You know, I of course, when I saw Sicario, I thought to myself, who wrote this absolutely brilliant script? And from that moment on, I thought, this guy is a writer to follow, you know. And I watched Helen High Water, I saw Wind River, which he directed, and then I started watching Yellowstone. I've seen every single episode, every single season. Then I watched 1883, and, you know, his... I think that he attracts these stars because of the excellence of his writing. And I really feel that actors respond to his work because he truly writes incredibly beautifully for actors.
And it's very unique in the way he builds characters. This Benicio del Toro's character in Sicario is just like... Yes. When you don't know how to feel about a character, it's like, okay, he's bad. But I want him to succeed, you know. So that's when that conflict happens. I think that's masterful writing when you can do that, and great acting, of course.
I totally agree. He manages to take characters that could be of dubious origin or of criminal character, and he manages to turn it. He manages to make them human, and that's what I think is incredibly rich in his universe. That's why Yellowstone is such a success. You know, some people sort of label it as a sort of, a conservative show, but it couldn't be more away from the truth. You know, when you see the subjects, you know, this is someone who's writing about the Native American experience. And 1923 takes it to a whole new level. We're going to see some subjects that are broached that are very important and that need to be told. And I am part of that subject, actually. I play probably one of the most disturbing characters I've ever played, I think. But I think it's a...
That brings joy to me. Anytime I speak with somebody and they're going to be the disturbing, going back to the Man in the High Castle, it's like and I'm Jewish and I'm rooting for some of the Nazis, you know, because you want them to have that redeeming moment, thing.
Yeah.
But no, it's funny you mentioned Taylor Sheridan, because I was speaking with LaMonica Garrida, you know, with his time on 1883.
He was wonderful on 1883,
Oh, indeed. And I told him, I said, listen, I want to see a prequel of just you and how you and Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
I want to see how y'all became, you know, how y'all got together.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I was watching it with my son, and I just love that show. And then when I, 1923, when I remember when it was announced, I was like, what is this going to be? You know, I'm kind of doing the math, and I'm trying to like cast it in my head. Okay, who's going to be doing what? You know, and to have. You know, a writer create all that. I mean, that's.
Just the fact that Harrison and Helen, you know, Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren boarded that show, and that you should see the array of character actors that are on it. You know, we're talking about Timothy Dalton, James Badgedale, Brian Geraghty, Marley Shelton, and these wonderful new actors coming up: Amina Nieves and Michelle Randolph and Darren Mann and Brandon Sklenar and all these actors who, the universe is beyond anything I read on a page. When I got the scripts, I could not put them down. It's one of the first times where I basically was begging to get the new episodes. I'm telling you, this is a cross between, and I saw the first episode and I was blown away. I thought to myself, yes, this is exactly what I envisioned. And people are not prepared for the scope and the epic proportion. It's not because I'm in it. It's an incredible show. It really is. It's as if you're going to be swept up in a sort of, it's Out of Africa meets Legends of the Fall meets Yellowstone. It's really, yeah, I thought I was reading Hemingway. I thought I was reading Snows of Kilimanjaro, For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Sun Also Rises, all mixed together. It was remarkable.
It's a little more, whereas 1883, this is not meaning to diminish it at all, but it's about one specific journey. It seems like there's more of an epic kind of there's a lot of angles to it, you know. And like you mentioned, like James Badgedale, he's one of those guys I always love seeing show up. Everything he's done, he's knocked it out of the park. But
absolutely,
but these like yourself, it's like they're people I, as a consumer of entertainment, you know, I love seeing show up. You're certainly one of those gentlemen.
You.
But
thank you.
One of my favorite interactions you've done is you and Ryan Reynolds was Six Underground, I think.
Oh, yes.
Across the desk from each other.
Yeah. It was actually a short interaction, but it was really good. It was wonderful.
That dialogue that y'all had is he would be a guy to have a hard time not breaking, you know, laughing with.
Yeah,
certainly. Now, okay, you moved to the U.S. You're in L.A.
Yep.
Was that just purely for work? Were you like, okay, this is where I need to be? The on camera thing's taken off. I'm going to go and be here. Let's say as opposed to New York, you just want to kind of taste all the flavor of the different big media markets in the U.S.
Yeah, I think it was also more than that. It was more of a time in my life when I needed. I was in a period of transition due to different personal things happening in my life, where I'd moved upstate New York. I'd renovated this house for 5 years. My marriage was ending. I got a show in LA. All these factors happened at the same time, and I felt I needed a transition. I needed something new. And in 2006, I was offered a job on a show, and I put my house for sale, and it went very well. And then suddenly I thought to myself, now is the time for me to change. I've spent 15 years in New York. I've done all I needed to do in New York. And yes, I felt that there was new opportunity. There was a new energy, actually. More than opportunity, it was all about energy. Something in the air told me that I needed to go west. You know, as one of these immigrants who was moving west, I was also moving west to seek to seek new opportunity. And my instinct was 100% right. I moved here. I bought a new house, a new environment, which was really vital for me to have a new home.
Now, did you land in Venice originally, or did you find your way there over the years?
Over the years, I'd house sat for people and been to Venice many times, and I thought to myself, this is the closest that I can reproduce. It felt like a sort of the New York of LA for me. As close as I could, anyway. And also the geographical location, the air was a little purer, it was closer to the sea, it just appealed to me. And also luck would have it that a friend of mine was in real estate and brought me to this house, and it's as if the house chose me, and I put a bid on the house, got it instantly before it was on the market, and having sold my house very, you know, well previously, I managed to make a bid, got the house, and this was going to become my universe. It's as if everything happened perfectly at the same time, and I've been here since, you know, and I've actually borne the fruits of being here, of following my bliss, following my instinct, and it really led me to bettering my career, bettering my life, meeting my future wife here, and you know, and being in a good place at the moment. Yeah.
Well, do y'all have any kids?
We don't have kids. No.
That's you have any pets though?
We have a dog that we love very much. That we absolutely adore, and we. No, we haven't. We decided. Yeah, we haven't actually brought up the idea of kids yet. Not even. Yeah, it's something that is not has not been you know, to go into a personal mind. Yeah, it's something that I haven't. What's the word that I could say? Yeah, I haven't. We haven't talked about it yet. It could happen, but it hasn't.
I will tell you, they're not a cheap investment.
No. Yes, I know. In America, that is, yeah. Because, you know, in Europe, everything's free. But, you know, but in America, it's expensive, yeah.
Yeah, no, I... But one of the things I loved living in Southern California was... I had a golden retriever. I have one now. But his predecessor and I would spend much time on the beach, you know, which I really enjoyed.
We love to do that, yeah.
Now, kind of moving forward, okay, there's one show I need to watch.
Yes.
Is The Vampire Diaries. Now, you did a little swing on that.
Yeah.
And now all my daughter's little teenage friends, they're picking up on it now, you know, and I'm sure Ian Somerhalder has nothing to do with it.
He's
all these teenage girls, you know. I look at that, and I look at another, there's a couple things you've done. I haven't seen The Young Pope. I still want to see that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting show, yeah.
But you've had a great eclectic mix of stuff you've done. The question is that an active choice, or are you always looking for something that's going to be, I don't want to say a challenge, but something you haven't done before, or is it just luck of the draw?
I think it was luck of the draw then. You know, I decided to come to LA. There was a period where I was on this other show, and then at the same time, you know, came Fringe, Supernatural, The Vampire Diaries, and the spin-off of The Vampire Diaries, the original. So nearly at the same time, all these shows sort of converged into my life. And it was the luck of the draw, really. I was shooting Fringe, I remember, and someone said, you have to, you know, audition for Supernatural. And I was like, I auditioned for them many times. And they were like, go. Got the parts. And little did I know that Supernatural has an enormous fan base, which would create, you know, fan bases are very important for the continuation of your career. And then while I was doing Supernatural, I auditioned for Vampire Diaries, and that which led to a truly amazing role, actually, on The Vampire Diaries. I played this 1,000-year-old vampire whose only desire was revenge, and he was an extremely complex character, motivated by revenge because he'd been betrayed by his family, and then which brought on the role of the originals, the same character, which was then transferred to a spin-off, and I could continue exploring that character's complexities in the future, which actually created an even bigger fan base because, you know, at the end of the day, it's the viewers that determine your success, in a way, if one can say so. And from that came on, you know, I chose a certain path in my life. I really wanted to start then approaching complex characters in truly quality. You know, it was the beginning of streaming, and I remember watching Man in High Castle thinking, I want to be on that show, and kind of willed it. I willed myself onto that show.
That's very cool. So you were watching it before you were ever even discussed being in it.
Yes, absolutely. Wow. And then kind of willed myself onto that show. The same thing kind of happened for 1923. I truly, truly loved the Taylor Sheridan universe. I truly admired that man and really wanted to work with him. and kind of willed myself on the show as well. And suddenly something came out of the ether and I turned down a lot of work because I wanted to wait for the perfect opportunity. And then suddenly 1923 came knocking on my door. And what a wonderful universe. You know, I'm truly proud of the work that I did on this. And it takes place in Montana. It shoots in Montana. We shoot in Butte and around Butte. And actually, it was my first time discovering the magnificence.
I've always wanted to go there, but I don't know how I would handle winters there. I don't know.
Oh, my goodness.
Southern guy. So,
yeah, the winter's pretty brutal. I was just there. I just finished shooting actually a few days ago, and the winters there are brutal, but staggeringly beautiful. As is the summer and the fall. I was really, really taken by this. You know, there's something truly magical about that state. You know, and then when you're riding horses there and you're driving and hiking in these extraordinary landscapes, you know, it makes you fall in love again with the staggering beauty of this country, really.
Yeah, I think there are so many places that I've yet to see that I think, you know, and you see it in pictures, and I've got a screensaver on my computer that pops up. I'm like, I want to go. I can drive there, technically, you know. So when you got a 1923, was that an extensive process of, you know, because sometimes some things like, hey, you want to do it? Great, you're on. You know, other times there's...
No, this time I had to, you know, audition. I auditioned for another character that I really wanted, didn't get it. And then the casting director, who's a wonderful casting director who always does quality work, John Papsidera, thought, you know, I think you would be, this character would fit you more. And I auditioned for the role of this character called Father Henry Renault, who is the head of a residential school for Native American, you know, for Indian Americans, and a very polarizing, unsavory character, one might say, very, very challenging.
Yeah, the members of the cloth back then were notorious for, even like in Hawaii, for trying to dissolve the cultural underpinning of, you know, the whole society, you know,
I think the members of the cloth have been doing that for centuries. I think all over the world, you know, the colonizing aspect of the church is actually one of the most terrifying aspects of the church. You know, something that I've always actually fought against and been hugely critical of. You only have to look at Africa and South America. But what happened in, you know, with these residential schools is something that needs to be talked about, and it is talked about in a most profound way in this series. And I think it's going to be very polarizing and very important after, you know, hearing, and very newsworthy after hearing of the Canadian, you know, residential school horrors, which mirror the horrors that happened in U.S. residential schools by the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah, you hear about that, or the Calvinist missionaries in Hawaii and how they just, like, they wouldn't allow native language,
yes,
native tongue to be... And you talk about a whole culture that has an oral tradition. They don't necessarily write everything down, so...
Yeah.
You know, but now, I have to say I don't see older lady, but mature lady, a crush. I got a crush on Helen Mirren. I think I remember watching her for years and just thinking, what a cool woman. And one of my favorite quotes she said was that,
my God,
I forgot where I saw this quote. And they said, in your whole life, what have you, what's one lesson you can pass along? She said, I should have told more people to fuck off. I was like, okay, I adore this woman.
That's wonderful.
Did you have screen time with Harrison Ford and or Helen Mirren?
So unfortunately, not yet, but, you know, we're going for a second season, and I suspect that I will. But just being around them on set, you know, I would actually go to set to watch them, because these are two people that I admire beyond, you know, I have unbelievable respect for both of them as actors, as artists. And I followed their careers, of course, for such a long time.
Well, doesn't Harrison Ford live in Montana or Wyoming? Doesn't
He's in Wyoming, I think. He's in the Tetons, Jackson Hole, I think, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, so I followed these two actors for a long time and admired them for a long time. And, you know, upon meeting them, was not disappointed by, first of all, the unbelievable passion that they have both for their craft, and how approachable and how wonderful they both are, you know, towards young actors. I mean, young, I'm not a young actor anymore, but younger actors. And so approachable, so professional, so... What I love is the passion is still there. You know, they've reached the firmament of acting, of what they could, you know, see as a career. And they continue being passionate and loving and generous towards, you know, their peers. And it's, there's nothing like it. You know, we were all discussing among ourselves, all, you know, us character actors with Badge and, you know, Brian Garrity and everyone on set, you know, Tim DeKay. We're all going, we're pinching ourselves. We are so happy to be here in this.
I'm envious. I'm like,
universe.
People of our age looking at like it's Harrison Ford and like the Star Wars and yeah. Indiana Jones and all that, you know.
And Witness, you know, let's not forget Witness, Mosquito Coast, Blade Runner. This man has a body of work that is so extraordinary. I know that he's been in some of the most successful movies of all time, but. And actually, his incarnations of Indiana Jones and Han Solo, I mean, are indelible.
I will admit, everybody looks at Mosquito Coast as being the one that should have gotten him an Academy Award. But I admittedly, it's one of those
Witness
ones that
as
I've,
well.
I loved Witness, but I've never seen Mosquito Coast. I don't know why. It's just never
remarkable.
There are films and TV shows out there that I'm thinking, well, I haven't seen it yet. Yeah, it can be new for me, you know. So, you know, I think that's going to be a wonderful experience to watch, and I'm envious that you get a second season being able to do it here. So
yes, but I'm so excited.
Well, before we wrap up, I always kind of throw out what I call my seven questions. Just it's a little bit of fun. Extra get to know you.
Of course, yeah.
I'm a food guy. If anybody listens to the show, I talk about food all the time.
Me too. Love cooking.
So one of the questions I got for is, what's your favorite comfort food? That thing that you have had the best day in the world, or maybe just a crummy day, and it's just something you land on and go, it soothes the soul.
It's really interesting. I mean, lately, because, you know, I'm truly passionate about Korean cooking, I absolutely love soup. A Korean soup called sundubu, which is a soft tofu soup, which is made with this extraordinary spice called gochujang.
Uh-huh.
And I actually learned to make it because I
really?
Yes, yeah, I love cooking. So, you know, of course, being raised in France and, you know, having explored Italy, and I speak Italian and Spanish as well. And so I'm truly passionate about, you know, cooking. But in terms of comfort food, I would say sundubu or an amazing arrabbiata, spaghetti arrabbiata. Pasta is always something that's a comfort food. These would be my go-tos, I think.
Now, I haven't had lunch yet. I'm sitting there going, God, that sounds so good. The extent of my Korean cooking is gochujang, just like throwing that in.
Gochujang,
that's about as far as I can get.
Gochujang is amazing.
Indeed, and I've got turned my kids on to it now, so they're all about it. But now, if you're going to sit down with three people, you're gonna have four of y'all are gonna have a conversation, just talk story for a couple hours. Who would those people be in your mind, you know, living or not? Somebody you would love to sit down and just chat with and glean wisdom from.
Oh my goodness, that's such a difficult story. I mean, for me, they would be writers, you know, or one of my great heroes, Laurence Olivier. Ernest Hemingway, because when I was a kid on the boat, I read Hemingway extensively. And I would have to say even, you know, Arthur Rimbaud, Charles Baudelaire, Victor Hugo, some of those great writers. There are so many to, you know, there are so many to talk about.
Well, the ones that fired off your imagination as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, that probably is like I think that would be wonderful. I should have read more as a kid. I don't know why I didn't. Should have. Now I'm kind of catching up on things I should read, you know.
The one who fired off my imagination the most also was Alexandre Dumas, who wrote The Three Musketeers. But the book that truly fascinated me as a kid was The Count of Monte Cristo. I read it on the boat, and it was just the most extraordinary book for me. It opened my mind to much more in literature,
Well, very good, very good. Well, I'm curious, next question, who was your first celebrity crush when you were a kid?
Do you know what's funny? My first celebrity crush is when I went to see Live and Let Die with Roger Moore, James Bond, Jane Seymour.
Oh, my, yeah.
Jane Seymour, my God. she was my first celebrity crush. She was that Bond girl, and yes, I remember it vividly. Yeah,
I will say, Roger Moore, he was my Bond growing up, but he's not necessarily my favorite Bond.
No.
But, you know, there's a, you know, I don't know. I'm a Daniel Craig and a...
Daniel Craig.
No, your fellow Scott. What? I'm drawing Casino, a blank to the original.
Casino Royale? Casino Royale?
Oh, the original actor. He's
Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
Sean Connery. Absolutely.
I tell you, Sean Connery and Daniel Craig were both my... I got bookends. Yes. Those are my favorites so far.
Absolutely.
Now, if you're going to go live on an island, which you have had experience living somewhere tropical, and you don't have streaming or anything, which I think for kids, I think it'd be a good thing to do, go to an island that's beautiful, no streaming, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to bring an album, and you have to bring, be it on vinyl or CD, or a DVD, a movie, and that's for a whole year. You're going to be there, and that's something you can keep going back to. What would the movie be, and what would the album be that you would bring with you to this wonderfully exotic, awesome place?
Do you know there's a movie I keep going back to, and I don't know why I go back to it all the time, but I do know why. I absolutely adore North by Northwest by Hitchcock.
Oh, Cary Grant's the guy.
It's one of my go-to movies with Raiders of the Lost Ark. Music-wise, that's so hard, but I think I would go for Concerto No. 21 by Mozart. The concerto for piano. It has a special significance for me because it reminds me of my father, but it also is something I grew up with on the boat. I would play it very often, and there's a very, very famous theme, the Elvira Madigan theme, based on this beautiful movie by a Swedish filmmaker. But it's the concerto No. 21 that I would never get tired of. I know that, you know, I could go into Miles Davis because, you know, Kinda Blue 2 is something that I think is akin to Mozart and Bach.
It's more or less things you can listen to while reading, I guess. If you were to say from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, what would be the component parts of a perfect day for you? You know, something that really, it's just kind of like, this is ideal. What would that be?
Well, getting up, first of all, perfect day. I love making my cup of tea. I take great pride in having the best loose tea because, you know, I think making tea is an art form. It's a very, as I love food, you know, making my tea with my special blend of Earl Grey and Lapsang Souchong mixed.
Oh, so you actually take the loose leaf and you mix it to make your own proprietary. I was actually thinking about doing that. I'm trying to find one of those little diffuser balls. I'm going to have to go online to get one of those.
No, I never use a diffuser ball. No. For me, it has to be in a teapot. It has to have that perfect mix, that perfect, you know, it has to steep for the perfect amount of time. And that's the perfect cup of tea, you know, perfect cup of tea. Then it would be, you know, actually being on an island, going for a swim in the sea. That would be, then it would be sitting down writing, because I'm really passionate about writing lately, and I've written a few things that I hope they will get to fruition.
Any screenplays or more like more novels?
Screenplays. And then, you know, spending time with my wife is always the most wonderful time. And the perfect day also would be hopping on a horse, riding for a few hours, then rock climbing, because I'm a huge, truly passionate about rock climbing. And yes, I love that. I mean, any physical exertion for me is
like rock climbing with the ropes where you're dangling.
I
get nervous watching people do it. I don't know why. There's some things I'm like, I can fly an airplane, but it's like rock climbing. No, not gonna do it. Don't know why, but
No. It's something I really love. I love the challenge of it. I discovered this 15 years ago and fell madly in love with it and continue doing it. It's very hard on the body, you know, it's hard, but it truly is an exercise of the mind. And then, you know, finishing by great me-making dinner, cooking, because I love cooking. I find unbelievable pleasure in cooking. It's my calming... It's my yogic experience, let's say.
I'm the same way. I order, there's a place called Spice House. I mean, I'm trying to give them an ad, but it's online Spice thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I look at how much I spent, like my last order, I'm like going, you know, there's the herbs and spices and it's things I haven't tried yet. And, you know, I've got all the little magnetic tins up on this on my wall, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And my youngest daughter gets in making spice blends with me. I'm like, for some people, it's a task.
That's wonderful.
For me, it's almost therapeutic to a degree, you know, cooking. And
it really, that's the word I was looking for. It's therapeutic. And actually, spices are so important. I've just discovered this wonderful Arab company where they have this Mediterranean spice that's this, and za'atar. You find it, actually, and that is really, it's a blend of many, many Mediterranean spices that I absolutely love.
I did something I took the other day. I'm a native Texan originally, so I made my guacamole, but instead of just chili powder, I used, I think, berbere, I think is how you say it. It's a Middle Eastern spice.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, berbere, okay.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, it did something. I'm like, I feel like, ooh, wait a minute. This is something maybe you'd have in a restaurant. I'm so proud of myself because I just tried something out. It's like, this had something kind of like that thing. Like, I don't know what it is. But next time, if you ever make guacamole, toss a little in there.
I'll try the berbere.
Now, the last couple questions for you. If you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your vocation if you weren't the thespian that you are?
Anything to do with music, I think, you know, piano, guitar, I would really love to be. I'd still like to be in the performing arts, you know. Because music has a great place in my life. I don't really play. I play guitar badly. I don't play the piano. My wife does. She's a really musical person. It would truly be in music. Yeah.
Now, the last question, if you were to jump in a DeLorean and cruise back to when you were 16 years old, what would be that one piece of advice you'd give yourself to either kind of like make that moment of your life maybe better or maybe put you on a little bit different track or put your mind at ease, anything? What would be your piece of advice to 16-year-old Sebastian?
I might have to basically replicate Helen Mirren's thing. Yeah, maybe I should have told more people to fuck off. But I think And I think actually it comes from the fact, you know, believe in yourself more. That's what I would have said. Believe in yourself. It gets better. Believe in yourself. Have confidence. And never shy away from something you're afraid of. Make yourself, as we say in French, fais-toi violence, make yourself violence, meaning that don't be afraid.
Make yourself violent? Make yourself violence?
Yeah, yeah. Se faire violence means to basically pick yourself up from the scruff of your neck and just go for it. Anytime there's an opportunity.
How do you say that in French one more time? Because I'm going to have to memorize this now. How do you say
it? So it means se faire violence.
You know, I've heard so many different incarnations of that from different folks I've spoken with, that it's just like, just do it, or don't be, you know, don't wait for permission and things like that. You know, it's...
Yeah,
it's like, don't you just wish you knew then what you know now? You know, when it comes to...
Exactly, yeah. You know, some people are born confident, and you know, some aren't, and they build it through their lives, and they attain, you know, the experience to become, you know, confident people. But, you know, yeah, when you're young, you really need to never be afraid. Just go for it. It's true. Do yourself violence in a good way. I mean that positively. Sorry, I cut you off.
That makes all the sense in the world. I think, especially when, you feel like, well, I got to live by others' expectations. It's like, this is your spin at the game.
Yeah.
You know, one last question. You being in L.A. and you being a food guy, have you eaten at Harrison Ford's son's restaurant by any chance?
I think I went once to, is it called Ford's?
Filling station.
Filling station.
I think it's Ford's.
Yeah, but it's not really my kind of food because I'm not a huge. I think it's a large emphasis on meat, right? If I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a huge meat eater. I mean, I will sometimes. I don't really eat that much red meat anymore. I'm more into, you know, but I'm still sort of, I'm not really a vegetarian. I still eat fish and chicken and, but I, you know, I'm more vegetable inclined now, let's say.
I most certainly need to be, and that's where my cooking skills got to take a turn. I can grab any kind of meat and do something with it, but I need to be getting more of those vegetables. But I so appreciate you taking time out with me today.
It was a pleasure.
I'm elated to see 1923 just because, as you mentioned, it is not just because you do have Harrison Ford, Helen Mirren, but it is this collection of really great character actors, yourself and James Badge-Dale, and the people that you love seeing show up are all, I mean, it's a kind of a murderer's row of the people you want to see.
Absolutely.
I'm so jazzed to see 1923. Mark, but have a wonderful one.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was a real pleasure talking to you. I love these kind of interviews, and it was an absolute pleasure talking to you. You have a great voice, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Got my brand. I swapped out microphones. You're the first person I've talked to with this new microphone here. So maybe it's doing something good. Who knows? But we're definitely, I will be making a stop through Venice. My daughter wants to come see it. We'll be there in a couple of days. So we're going to be walking around trying to find good places to eat. But you have yourself a wonderful one.
Anytime. Thank you so much, Mark. Take care.
All right. There you go. Sebastian Roche. Really enjoyed the opportunity to sit down and have a chat with him. And of course, 1923 is available right now on Paramount Plus. Check it out. Really enjoy the show. And don't forget, check out storyandcraftpod.com. Everything you could possibly want to know about the show. Make sure to follow and, of course, like the show. No matter what podcast app you use, that way every episode that comes out, you'll get a little notification to listen. All right, that's it. I'm going to head on out, grab a bite to eat, and you have an amazing rest of your day. And don't forget, next week, let's get back together again for another episode of Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.